Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, before we get the show started, I wanted to let you know we are giving away a bunch of brand new Black Magic gear.
Yeah, cameras, switchers, DaVinci Resolve licenses, a bunch of awesome stuff. So stay tuned to learn how you can enter to win free gear from Black Magic, and we're going to tell you all about it later on in this episode. Now cue the music.
Hey everyone, welcome to the 95th episode of Just Shoot It, a podcast about storytelling, filmmaking, and directing. I'm Oren Kaplan.
And I'm Matt Enlow. Today we've got Mercedes Bryce Morgan on the show. She's a director that I've known for a little while. She broke making a viral interactive show for Echo, and now is releasing the new season of Stargate. So she's had a really meteoric rise. She's got a ton of really interesting insights. She learned a lot from this kind of giant action-driven sort of set. We're going to dive in deep with her on the nature of making a big series like this, but also one that is really highly regarded by a fandom, and what sort of pitfalls and challenges she found in respecting something that people love so much, but also making it her own. So it's a really great episode if you're interested in the kind of worlds of science fiction and also pre-existing IP.
Yeah, my favorite part of the conversation is when we do kind of a deepish dive into how she shot lists, how she shoots action, how she comes up with camera movement and things of that nature, which I always love discussing, and I feel like our listeners do too. So I'm really excited about this conversation. But before we get to Mercedes Bryce Morgan, I'd love to know, Matt, what's been going on lately?
Well, yeah, we had the live show last week. It was an utter delight. It was great to see everybody in Los Angeles. Our friends at Adaptive, shout out to Katie and Zeb who helped us out, and then also Kate and Steven who were there, and the other Kate.
Yeah, three Katies. We had three Katies and three Matts.
Yeah, too many. But yeah, it was a real treat. I guess we didn't get to talk about it on the show because we were just hosting a podcast, but it was really special to get to hang out with people, and I want to do it again relatively soon, in a couple months, I'd say.
Yeah, for sure. If you missed this past live show, then we are going to do a few more this year. It's really fun to get to meet our audience, and so
if you go to justshootitpod.com, on these show notes, I promise to have a link to sign up for the events list.
Okay.
I have a MailChimp account, guys. I listen to podcasts. It's going to be great. But yeah, and also, you know, tweet at us. Let us know if there were things that you really liked about the live show, things that you think we could improve upon, things that you wish that we talked about, all of that stuff. I think it was really great. I think a special thing that, you know, we were hoping would happen is that it was great to see people from other listeners kind of meeting each other and interacting with each other. I think some friendships were born at that first live event. Wouldn't you say, Oren?
Yeah. What I found interesting was that there were a lot of non-directors that came. We had actually a lot of DPs, some screenwriters, some producers that listened to the show and just like hearing. I mean, I don't know. This might be like a little cocky, but I kind of feel like a director does everything on set, like needs to know about everything on set. And so I think maybe on this show, we touch other departments as well. And so it was cool to see not just directors there.
Yeah.
Because I'm sick of directors.
Ugh. We talk to them every week. Just kidding. It's been great. Well, yeah. It was such a good time. Shoot us an email with feedback. We're going to do it again soon. Probably a different location each time, but thanks to our friends at Adaptive for hooking it up.
Yeah, that was really cool.
Oren.
Yes.
I would really love to know, though, what have you been working on lately?
You know, I told you, I think I've talked about on the podcast that I'm doing these plumbing commercials in Houston. They're really fun. They're 4 30-second comedy spots. We're shooting over 2 days. And I think this might be the first time I've done this, but I did like a pre-flight out to Houston where we did casting and we did locations. And so I'm sure a lot of our listeners like already know about how all this works. But to those that don't, like, what's cool is, so we have a locations manager and she goes and she basically starts sending me all these houses she's shot at before, and she starts putting the feelers out for new houses, and I just get a link with pictures of all these houses. I narrow it down, I select all my favorite houses, the agency selects their favorite houses, and then they set up one day where we're gonna go to 6 houses. And then the same thing happens with auditions, right? They send me a link of all the auditions, I select all my callbacks, the agency does. Let me ask you, Matt, how many people would do you call back for an audition?
Per role?
Let's say I want to know per role if there's a number, or per day. Because to me, if I'm casting 13 roles, I'll call less people per role than if I'm casting one role.
That is definitely true.
So we were casting 13 roles.
13 roles, right. Over how many days? Just one day?
One day.
Oh, boy. Because I would say a bare minimum, I would call in 5 people, but it's probably closer to 10 or even 15.
So my lists were between 8 and 12 per role. And 4 of the roles were for like kind of the same. So it was really more like 9 roles.
Yeah. Is there any room to like, are there roles where it's like, okay, well, I just need, you know, I need 3 white moms, so you can bring in say 20.
Yeah.
And then slice it up and just kind of pick your 3 favorites.
Yeah. So 4 of those roles were like that. They were all kind of the same idea. So let's say 9 roles. So yeah, my instinct was to bring 10 people each per role. We had an entire day. My flight out was at 9 p.m. We had an entire day to cast. And the people at the agency are like, what? That is way too many people. Like, bring 5, maybe 6 people. As the agency, we're only going to pick our 2 favorite for each role.
Well, yeah, I think that's okay. But also, I guess they have to be there for all of them, right?
Yeah.
So typically, I'm like, yeah, suck it up, losers. Let's do it. I want to do this right. That's why you hired me.
Right. Well, so we ended up, you know, I was trying to be nice. So we ended up bringing in 6 people per role. And we finished like 3 hours early. And I just sat at the airport for 3 hours. I wish we would have brought in 10 people per role because our casting director did a great job of grouping all the actors together in the same scene. So if you have a scene with 3 actors... then you're seeing 3 actors at a time. That's right. Like, you should be able to bring 3 times as many actors.
Did you ever hold someone like, oh, you think that maybe they're really good, but they got stuck with a partner that didn't click with them? Did you ever hold anyone over to mix them with someone else or no?
Yeah, we did. We did like some chemistry stuff a little bit. That stuff is so hard because, well, so we cast out of Houston. We had actors there from Austin, Dallas, San Antonio, and Houston. It takes 3 hours to drive there from some of those locations. Mm-hmm. So I already like feel really bad about these actors. And we had this one moment where there was a lot of people in our room. There were about 9 people on my side of the table for the auditions. And there were a couple moments where a few people on my side of the table were whispering to each other during a take.
Nope, don't do that.
Even though they're the bosses and they call the shots and they're... not that it matters, but they're like significantly older than me, you know, probably my parents' age. I still felt like I had to be like, guys, please, these people some of them drove 3 hours. This is the callback, so it's their second time. So 6 hours of driving for this. They are not getting paid 1 cent. It's all on their dime. Like, the least we can do not throw them off during their audition. So
You say it just like that?
Yeah, but I didn't say it in front of, I like kind of pulled them aside and said that. And I said, I'm sorry, like, I totally understand, you know, and don't mean to be a jerk, but I said, like, look, I really like actors and I really appreciate that they're here for us. And it's important for me that they feel appreciated.
I wonder if they'll respect you more for it or if they'll be like, Oren is difficult.
Yeah, I have no idea.
I mean, who cares, right?
Yeah. But I did give every single actor at least 3 takes, which I couldn't have done if we would have had way more actors, but we had so much time. So anyway, that whole experience was interesting in how I kind of pre-scouted and pre-cast and then finished it in Houston. But now I'm back here for a week doing the writer's room while we're prepping, storyboarding, everything. And then I'm flying back there on Sunday with the DP and the producer. Then we do a day of fittings and tech scouts and then a day of pre-art dressing, and then 2 days of shooting, and then I come back on Friday. So it's pretty, it's like, I don't know,
that's,
it's interesting.
Good beginning of the year, man.
Yeah, but you know what's interesting, and we talked about this on our commercials episode, it's a 2 day shoot, so I get paid for 2 days of work.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I think it's a good rate. I actually have no idea how much money I'm making on this.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I asked the producer and she's like, I don't know. Your pay doesn't come out of my budget. It comes out of like the production company's budget. So
and it's not pre-negotiated. I was going to say, sometimes it used to be standard that you would get a half rate for prep days. So shoot days are full rate, and then travel and prep could, depending on who's negotiating for you and how much money's in the kitty, you could be making even more than you think.
Yeah, I don't know. So, well, so the last company I was with, he was like, this is your day rate. You know, we're going to say this is how much you cost per day, which was great, but I didn't get any work with them. So it doesn't, it's like the whole point of things moot. With this production company, the general manager is like, look, we're always going to try to get you paid as much as we can.
Right.
And you just have to trust us. Some jobs will be more, some jobs will be less. The last job I did with them, it was a one-day shoot, was super simple. I mean, we cast it and then shot it the next day, and I never talked to anyone again about it. This job is just so much more involved with all these flights and going, being gone for a week.
Which is all an argument towards being able to
get paid for the prep.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. But I don't think at the end of the day, it's no one's negotiating for me. The production company represents me and also represents the budget.
Right. Wait, hold on. Is the famous group the production company?
Yeah.
Oh, I see. Ugh. Yeah, so that's a conflict of interest then.
Well, but that's how it is in commercials, right? RSA is a production. Tool is the production company. Whatever, you know.
Yeah, I guess so.
Gifted that's Youth true. Is the production company.
So then it should just be 10% of that budget.
Yeah, 5 to 10%, I guess. If it's $1 million, should you get $100,000?
Yeah.
Dude, no.
That's why you do commercials, homie.
They give the director $100,000 for $1 million commercial.
Yeah, man.
What if of that $1 million, $950,000 of it goes to Justin Bieber for being in the commercial?
I think, well, if $950,000, but then that's not $1 million.
Okay, $500,000 goes to.
I don't know, man. I guess, look, I'm not in the position to really answer that with any authority, but I will say this. The reason we are in commercials is because we love them and also because of the money. Do you know what I mean? Like, everyone's full rate in commercials.
Yeah. I mean,
we're the least full rate.
Yeah. I mean, this is a non-union commercial, you know? So to me, union is like the full rate.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
Right. So, and that's like a big part of why they wanted to shoot in Houston. And I was really fighting to cast out of LA because we just have so many more great actors.
Yeah, I mean, I think you should just talk to them. I mean, the other wonderful thing about it is that at this level, you're going to be pretty happy no matter what. Like, a bad rate is still like a rate that you would take.
Yeah, I mean, I'm excited.
Gladly, you know what I mean?
Yeah, booking one commercial for January makes me feel like I don't have to worry again until February 1st. Yeah. one other kind of interesting thing about this, and this is, might sound like a brag or a boast, but it's totally not. I don't mean it in that way. There was like a little bit of an air of like excitement that they got like an LA director to come direct these local commercials in Houston, which is funny because
it feels good, right?
Well, it's like in LA, you are one of a bazillion people. Mm-hmm. And then in Houston, they're like, oh, we could use like our local person, or we could get like someone from LA that does a lot of commercials, you know? And it's like, doesn't even matter if you have actually done a lot of commercials, but the fact that you're from LA kind of makes them feel like you're coming from like a better market. So you might be better talent. So I've never really experienced that before where people are like, oh, he's from LA, so he must be legitimate.
Mm-hmm.
Again, our show constantly talking about how great LA is. I apologize for that. It's just something that we keep noticing. I don't know.
Life is good.
So anyway, and we're continuing the writer's room. We our last day, which I actually missed because I was in Houston, but we did that whole thing with the whiteboard where we've mapped out what happens in the first five episodes.
Yeah. How you feeling?
I mean, I'm super bummed that I missed. That's the day I missed. It was built on like all our previous conversations. But I'm excited / stressed out of my mind because like a week full of writer's rooms while I'm prepping for this job and then leaving town. But yeah, I think it's as Eben Kosbar, our producer friend, would say, it's Uptown Problems.
Oh, yeah, sure. I thought you were going to say you're in the fire.
Oh, no.
In the fire is when you're like kind of on a hot streak of like, it's a pressurized situation, but you're like making the calls and making the shots and like doing it, you know, like you're in it.
Yeah.
That's in the fire. I always like that one.
Yeah, that's good. Uptown Problems is like, yeah, you sure. got to choose between two good jobs.
Yeah, yeah.
Cool. Well, I'm going to stop talking about how great my week is. And we're going to talk to Mercedes Bryce Morgan about how great her stuff is.
Mercedes.
Hello, hello.
Hello, welcome. I'm going to call you Bryce. I'm
yeah,
gonna make
call
a
me
mistake.
Bryce.
I'm going to definitely do that. So you go by both. But,
yeah.
But you prefer Mercedes, but I met you first as Bryce.
Wait, yeah. But is it that you prefer Mercedes or that there's already a Bryce Morgan on IMDb?
All right, here's the story of the name.
Yeah, yeah.
So my full name is Mercedes Bryce Morgan. And when I was younger, I was like, oh, wow, J.K. Rowling goes by J.K. because she doesn't want people to know she's a woman. Mm-hmm. And so I started going by Bryce, my middle name, as a young filmmaker, because I'm like, oh, there like aren't any woman directors. I'll be able to get in the room and people won't know, and then that will be okay. And then people start speaking out and they're like, it's awesome to be a woman director. And I'm like, I'm going to own up to this. And it's great. And now it's great to be a woman director.
There you go.
Oh, wow.
Look at that.
Wait, yeah. At what age did you think I should have this pen name?
Yeah, I think I was 20.
Oh, okay. Oh, so it's not like you were like 12.
No.
Yeah, yeah.
So when you were 20.
This went from a very precocious, like, story to like, oh man, this is it's a different deal though, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Wait, so 20 years into your life, did you tell your friends to start calling you Bryce?
Yeah, and actually some friends were like not okay with it. I had one friend who said, how could you, you didn't ask me. They said, I'm not gonna ask you to change my name, I'm just gonna do what I want. And other people, like my mom, was totally supportive of it. And
so it has nothing to do with IMDb or like another Bryce Morgan.
No, I don't think there are any other like Mercedes Bryce Morgans that I've met yet. There probably are because there's some of everybody.
I have a Facebook group of Matt Enlows.
Nice.
That is true.
Do you guys all message each other?
Not really. I think it's just funny to be on the group.
So there's an Oren Kaplan that has contacted me numerous times. We're friends on Facebook now because he was getting all these emails from me and finally he tracked me down and forwarded them to me. But whenever I get an email from him, I always assume it's like a virus or spam or something because I'm like, I didn't email myself.
On a similar note, my friend Liz Miller, who writes for IndieWire, old friends, Liz Miller is a pretty common name, right? And so she had a blog called Not That Liz Miller, I think it is. And it was all about the different emails that she would receive from other people reaching out to different Liz Millers. And it was all sorts of crazy personal stuff. And then she wrote this incredible blog post that we'll have to post about she was going through this big breakup and another Liz Miller was planning for a wedding. And so she was constantly getting these emails from another Liz Miller about like how wonderful Liz's life is and how this relationship is working out so well. Right in this heart-wrenching,
right,
terrible.
So hearing love songs while you're going through a breakup.
Yeah, yeah.
That's awful.
And a really killer story. So I hope Liz should turn that into a screenplay one of these days. Right. Liz, I hope you're listening.
Okay, enough about names.
So, Mercedes, we first met, we were working on a show called Fantasies for Full Screen. And I remember there was this weird day where all of the directors were shooting all of the intro sequences, which was a bonkers day. You also had an episode on top of that.
So yeah, an insane day.
It was an insane day. But the thing that really struck me, I remember, is that kind of last minute, the producers had decided that we kind of needed a universal intro sequence for the entire series, basically. Like, instead of just rappers, they also wanted to do basically a title sequence. And I was coming into the show on the back half of the season, so I knew that like it wouldn't really make sense for me to weigh in too much, but it was something that these were the decisions that were going to affect literally everybody's episodes. And all of the directors were on set that day. And I kind of remember like showing up and like saying hello to people. And like, you know, I'd worked with a lot of that crew before. So I was like palling around and saying hello and kind of was like, I wonder what's the plan for this intro sequence stuff? And someone was like, oh, Bryce is shooting it already. And I remember just turning over and being like, okay, you're like in it already.
And just so our listeners know, Bryce is Mercedes.
Sure, sure.
Bryce-ades.
Bryce-ades. So yeah. Mercedes, you were shooting it already. Like in maybe like, you were like, like on the ground, you know, like real directory pose, you know what I mean? And like, I think everybody else was just like sitting around with their fingers up their nose, and like you would kind of just like charged in and were already shooting the sequence without like waiting for anybody to say anything.
Was there one DP?
There was one DP.
There was one DP. So, but
like, was Bryce assigned to go first?
Yeah. So, I mean, what happened on this day is, how many pages? This was one of the
most
insane days.
It was 27 pages.
27 pages in one day. And I think there was four different directors there. Yeah. And I also had an episode on the same day. So, yeah. We did major OT. And it was just same crew and, like, kept switching directors out.
To our listeners, OT is overtime.
Yeah, overtime. The reason why I was on the ground is because if the actors have to sit on the ground, I like to sit on the ground.
Oh, that's nice.
Like, if the actors have to get in the water, I'll get in the water. Oh. And so I'm always seen in very odd areas around the set.
I used to have that mentality, and then I was like, I don't need to get in the water.
There's this really good documentary, Werner Herzog making Little Dieter Learns to Fly or something. Like, or some movie he made with Christian Bale where they're supposed to eat insects, and Walter Herzog just like goes in and just starts eating all these crickets and ants and all these things. Like, just eat them. Just do it. It's no big deal.
Yeah, that's funny.
And then he like threw up.
Yeah. But I love the wireless director's monitor, and that allows me to just, you know, sit on all surfaces. Yeah. But yeah, so for that day, we had talked about everything, but everyone was just kind of talking instead of just going
instead
into
of
it.
Shooting. And like, we had 27 pages.
I was like, guys, this is how we're doing it. Yeah, we're going to go ahead and go for it. And just checked in with all the different directors to make sure we had the same style going on.
Yeah, yeah.
And we just had to go for it.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
It was great.
Yeah. And it was also cool to like see how other directors worked.
It was a weird thing to do. Yeah. Yeah.
So you guys all, like, when you finished yours, you stayed around to see how other people
I hung around. You know, it's interesting because I don't think it was with you. I think there was another director where, like, maybe I pitched some jokes and shouldn't have. Do you know what I mean? Like, I have a impulse to, like, want to get in there. And I would be okay with that. Like, if you were like, hey, stupid, here's a good joke, and it was good, I'd use it. Do you know what I mean? But that's not always the case with people. Or like, you know, I said I'd worked with this crew, like Bobby the DP, I met my second day of college. Like, I introduced him to the producers, so like I wasn't worried about like losing face in front of the crew at all. But that's a stupid thing to do, even if it's like a good idea. And I remember just being like, I should back off. He didn't say anything to me. It wasn't like he was annoyed or anything, and it was quiet. It wasn't in front of the whole crew, but I was remember thinking like, I should just like let people do their thing instead of like palling around. Yeah. You know what I mean?
But I think that also comes from a place like we're all directors. And so we just feel very comfortable like being there and being in charge.
Yeah, sure.
And on the last project I did, we had a separate second unit stunts director.
Oh, so, interesting.
Yeah. And so I haven't been able to have that before. So it was really awesome. Actually, I have in the past, but it didn't work out the way it should. So I've been very, very picky about allowing other directors to come on and do that. But in this case, he was super awesome. And we had this huge stunt sequence where on that day we were supposed to go off and do separate things. Mm-hmm. But the ceiling of our soundstage cracked. And so it wasn't safe to be on the set. And so we had to shut down production for 3 days. And we kept on thinking we were going to be able to shoot. We couldn't. So our schedule got completely messed up. The entire last week, we had to do night shoots on a soundstage. Ooh. And so we would have like a 7 p.m. call time. And everyone's like, why are we doing this?
Oh, wait, because there was light coming through the crack?
There wasn't light coming through the crack, but they're like, yeah, this could fall on your heads at any minute. So like, do not go in there.
But they didn't think it could fall at night?
No, it was just like after it was fixed, all of our like 12-hour turnarounds just got shifted so much. Ugh. And we were doing OT, so it just like rolled over to that's like what we were doing, and we were like losing actors at the end, so we couldn't just like start over again. But
that is
it was brutal. But the reason so why I tell hard. That is so on that day I was supposed to be off shooting something else, and the way that it turned out is I didn't have anything else to shoot anymore. And so they said, hey Mercedes, you could just direct the scene now. But I said, no, like this second unit director has been working with the actors for a really long time, and I promised this to him, and it would just be like so horrible of me to just like come in and rip away this huge
sure.
So I was like, okay, I'll be like here and I'll be around, and my DP and I will be like here for you guys. Right. But it was weird just because that day on set was the most horrible feeling, because I'm just like, I don't know what to do.
Yeah. Like,
and you feel useless. Yeah, sure. And it shouldn't, because you know that everyone's out there doing stuff that you prepped and you're all part of the same thing.
Right.
But we're just used to the fact, it's like, if we're not running around, then we're not doing our jobs.
Right. Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's so hard to just be like, all right, I'm going to sit in a director's chair and like sprinkle things in here and there. Yeah. That's so fascinating. Yeah.
Well, I wonder if there is like a proper channel. Like if you're on set, let's say you're a DP or a guest or a friend or something, and you're like watching a scene and you have like an idea for like an amazing joke, or something's not working and you have an idea for how to make it work. Is there a proper channel to send that through? Like, could you whisper it to a producer that could filter it and bring it to the director? Or
I think that it depends on director to director and the relationship. But I do remember very distinctly on the Go 90 thing I just did, towards kind of the end of the shoot, everyone knew each other really well. The crew was awesome. And an AC of mine very quietly kind of like came over and like put his back to everybody and just kind of whispered in my ear a note that was like basically him reminding me of something that he remembered me saying I wanted to do. And just being like, hey, I remember you saying you wanted this, in case you want to make sure you get it. Like, literally no one else could hear. And I was really struck by how thoughtful and good and engaged that instinct was, you know, because his whole job is just pulling focus the whole time, right? So, like, those guys are, you know, it's easy to just be on your phone or, like, not
usually
really.
Usually they don't even read the script.
Yeah. Why would you, right? Just, like, make sure everything's sharp and you're good to go, right?
For the record, ACs do a little more than pulling focus. But
sure, yeah.
They do
a lot,
but on a different.
Yeah, I didn't mean to denigrate what he was doing. But I guess what I'm saying is, like, he was already doing his job, and, like, engaging in the story wasn't an essential part of that. And then to have the foresight and thoughtfulness to come in a very polite way, give me a note, I thought was great. Actually,
there's something really nice when the whole crew has like read the script and knows what the thing you're shooting is. And like when I would just like dolly grip on AFI short films, like I kind of prided myself on like always listening to the director and the DP's conversations, so that by the time they're done talking, like I have the camera in the right position and they don't have to like track me down and tell me to put it here and explain what the move is going to be. And like, it is kind of frustrating. I mean, yes, that AC is awesome. But it's almost frustrating when you're like, yeah, in this part, Monica is going to walk over here and like tell Chandler she loves him. And they don't know who like Monica or Chandler is.
Right,
it's like,
right. Dude,
come on.
Yeah. Now, that's something I really like, to be able to have like the gaffer and the key grip at table reads, which I don't think
great.
Is a standard. But
yeah,
I think it's really important. And people always have like a wrap party. My new favorite thing is to have pre-production parties. So right before you shoot, you get drunk with your crew and everyone becomes friends.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah. Like, and so like the first day, I feel like everyone's more in sync because they don't know, like they know everyone's name and they get what's going on. Like you said, they know the character names.
And would you do that on like a 2-day shoot also, or just like a
probably
longer
not
short
just like
shoot?
A longer shoot. I think on a 2-day shoot, you're just like, yeah, we have like a 2 weeks for prep if we're lucky, and sometimes we have a couple days, so let's just go.
Yeah. So Mercedes, go ahead and let's give us a little bit of backstory of like what you do, what your point of view is, and give us the cliff notes on your life.
Career highlights.
So I am a freelance director and producer, and I went to USC Film School, and I've been living in LA probably for 6 or 7 years now.
You went to undergrad?
Went to undergrad there, yeah. And when I was there, I just started my own production company, and I just started working full-time. And, you know, didn't go to a lot of parties because I was working the whole time. but they say you do something, you just got to do it fully. And so I've done all types of things. I've done commercials and music videos and digital series. And I just really love that we're in a time now where we get to do narrative. Like, that's what's so awesome about digital, is a lot of times people will go from just commercial or music video into other things. But now we actually get to tell stories, and it's way more closely linked to that. And so that's what I really love, is just
like
telling.
Branded content, you mean? Or you mean that all the genres are kind of overlapping each other?
Basically, like, because digital series didn't used to exist, you could make music videos narrative before you went into TV or movies. But now you can actually make
shows that are 10 by 10s and be able to transfer that into longer form narratives.
Cool. And yeah. Some highlights from your career. You did a show for Echo.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Two shows or one show?
So I did two shows for Echo.
So Echo is the interactive series where the viewers are. We had another guest, Sandeep Parikh, on here. He did Moment One.
Yeah.
Have you heard of that?
Yeah.
So your shows were similar, right?
Yeah. Like you... And so the first show I did was called Virtual Morality, and that's what kind of launched my career because it went viral and it had over 15 million views. And what was awesome about it is we had all of these different YouTubers like PewDiePie started reviewing it. And so we had all these gamers start watching it. And so it was something that we made for no money, no stars, and it just like rocketed.
And what was it?
People made fan art and it was wonderful. So Virtual Morality is a murder mystery at a high school party. And so you go in, you're this very Catholic girl, and you go in and you figure out that there's this thing going on. It says, don't like, don't share, don't subscribe. But everyone likes and shares and subscribes to the murders that are going on, fully perpetuating it further. But that was kind of our first try at making something interactive. And so we just had a normal branching structure. And so there's probably about like 20 or 30 different ways you could play an episode. But we said, okay, this is a new awesome way of storytelling. So when I did my next project, which is called Chatterbox Escape the Asylum, where you are this guy, Jed, that has two voices in his head and you have to escape the asylum, there's 500 different ways you could play it. And so no matter how you play it, it's more like a game. And so you will have a different experience instead of someone else. Yeah.
Yeah, that's so crazy. I didn't realize that your show went viral. That's a hard thing to do always, but then also when it's an interactive video and you're trying to like you have to ask a viewer to buy in in a more substantial way. So well done, that's incredible.
Thank
I didn't
you.
Realize that.
Yeah. How many episodes was that?
So it was three episodes.
And how long were they?
And that's hard to say because it's interactive, but anywhere from 7 to 15 minutes play time per episode. So we had to make about 45 minutes worth of content
per episode.
Total. Each episode was like 15 minutes worth of content.
And then so how were you involved in the press at all? Like how did you get PewDiePie to review it?
Just Reddit. People shared it on Reddit, and what PewDiePie does is he looks at what other YouTube gamers are posting, and once those become popular, they work their way up the gamer chain on YouTube, and that's how I reached him. And so once he liked it, that's when everyone started watching it.
But so did you, was that just an accident, or did you go to Reddit and like kind of promote it there?
My fellow creator, Elon, who's the writer, just posted it on one Reddit thread, and then just people just started sharing it and reviewing it. Yeah, which is crazy because people are like, how does something go viral?
Sure.
It's like, I don't know, people just start sharing it. Like,
yeah,
there's
right
no
place,
way
right
that
time.
That happens.
Well, there's definitely ways to get it. Like, it would have probably gone viral without that Reddit post, but even just that Reddit post, like, sometimes that type of thing hits, which obviously it did for you, but sometimes it doesn't, and then you do the Facebook post or the share it with like the exact right group of people.
Yeah. And I think what we had going for us is because gamers really loved it. I think it's like having a core audience. So they're like, oh, this is like a gamer thing. Or if you're making for a queer audience, like the people look for that type of content.
Right.
Yeah.
And that gamer audience is like so connected digitally to each other.
Yeah. And they actually want to go through and watch something. That's what's cool about interactive videos is like, we have problems trying to get people not to click away from stuff in the first 20 seconds. But when people watch these, like these episodes, they watch them three times over. And so you actually are able to hook someone's attention, which is so hard to do nowadays because they're involved in it.
Right. And that is interesting. Matt and I have talked a lot about these interactive shows, and they do seem tricky to get interested in, you know, because I think one way to look at it is like, I want to relax and I want you to guide me, you know, and as a director, you want to feel like you have a specific plan for the viewer's like emotional roller coaster or whatever.
Yeah.
Not that you don't with these interactive shows, but you have to have like a bunch of plans.
Yeah, you have to have a bunch of plans. And I also just think, not to like hit the gamer thing over the head, but people who don't like to play video games want to sit back and not interact with their video. And so they're probably not going to respond to that just because of the type of content
you
have.
Yeah.
And so that's why like sometimes you see these like 3 minute long, like love romance-y things, which are awesome and really cool, like Possibilia, but that's just, it's creating new content that doesn't necessarily have an audience yet. And so that's really hard because it's not whether your work is good or not. It's just people not used to that type of thing.
Right.
Yeah, that's actually really insightful. Kind of matches up with what that conversation I had with Kate Grady the other day, which said she said that Echo does want to move more in the direction of like the Escape the Asylum type of tone and audience, you know, and less the comedy side of things, because it's probably because of what you just said, because that stuff connects with the audience that is interested in interacting with what they're watching.
But yeah, so I've done a lot of interactive stuff. And the most recent thing I did was a series for MGM of the new Stargate show.
Right, like a reboot.
Yeah, reboot. So it's the origin story. And so that was really wild, taking something that people have loved for many, many, many seasons and sticking true to canon. And
Yeah,
which is really intense. Like, we had a Stargate expert on board, and so every time we do something, it's like, can this light be this color? Because how has it been for, you know, this many seasons? And we have to check everything by that.
So did you go back and watch every episode of every season?
That would have taken me years, so no.
Because there was like 4 or 5 shows, right?
There's like 18 seasons.
Oh, man.
Of all
and
the different
multiple
shows.
Multiple movies.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a lot of content. So no. But I went back and like watched different episodes from different seasons to make sure I familiarize myself with it.
You still had a crash course, even if you didn't have the total number of hours.
Yeah, as much as I could have.
Yeah.
And the characters are from the original movie.
Yes. There are new characters too, though. But yeah, so that was another thing, is like taking characters that are already established and working with that, which is what you do with any TV show or anything. But just the fans on Stargate are known for being a lot more intensely invested than any other fans.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
The sci-fi fans in general kind of have that thing, right? Especially maybe TV sci-fi. When you've got 18 seasons, right, and you're sticking with something for so long, that's kind of part of the appeal, right?
Yeah.
Like, there's kind of a mythology that you get to be excited by and adhere to. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like your world as well. And I feel like you feel like it's you're personally attached to it. Mm-hmm. And so when someone doesn't do it justice, it hurts you personally.
Sure.
Yeah.
Which I get, but it's also a very big responsibility, because you can't create something that people already had, because why would you want to create something that's already been done?
Right.
But if you do something that's too new, people get upset. And so it's just like something you're not able to win.
Yeah.
Well, that's like The Force Awakens. I thought it was fine. I didn't love it. And it's because it felt like exactly the same as like the first Star Wars.
But yeah.
I totally get why. And I mean, it overall was very successful. But yeah,
also
it's tricky.
That's safe. Yeah. I mean, then they're putting so much money into
it. Like Ghostbusters rebooted.
The Last Jedi. Fanboys were so mad about The Last Jedi.
I haven't seen it. Don't tell
me. Oh, really?
Anything. Yeah.
I haven't either. So
I'm working on it.
You haven't yet.
Look, so it. I loved it, actually.
I love Rian Johnson.
Not to talk too much about
Rian Johnson.
Yeah. But it's the exact sort of thing that you're talking about. It's like J.J. Abrams really kind of stuck to what we think a Star Wars movie is supposed to be and delivered that. And that is fun, but also feels really stale in its worst parts. And then The Last Jedi kind of doesn't care about a lot of canon, right? And that's kind of like freeing and exciting, but like there were a lot of people who felt betrayed by it. They were like, but you know, you set these things up and you paid them off in ways that we weren't expecting, or like my fan theory is wrong, you know, all of that stuff.
Right.
And as filmmakers, it's fascinating to have that sort of baggage on a series like that. So let's talk a little bit more about that. It's so fascinating to
me.
I guess I hadn't wrapped my head around how Stargate has so many seasons.
Yeah. Well, I mean, also, so when it got announced at Comic-Con, something that was like I'd never experienced before is I had people emailing me from France and Germany around the world being like, we're so happy, don't mess it up.
Really? Did they give you specifics as to how not to mess it up?
No, it was just like one sentence emails that was like, to let me know they were really excited and it was really awesome. But at the same time, it's like, all right, here we go.
Are they getting your email off of like your website?
So that's another thing, is I had not taken my email off my website at that point because I'd never received emails in that bulk before.
Yeah.
And so after that, I took my email off my website.
And so did you write it, or how involved were you in the scripting?
So they had a writer's room, but because I was an executive producer on it as well, I was able to like be there in the story process. And actually our writing overlapped with our pre-production. And so we started pre-production off of an outline. Mm-hmm. And so we were giving notes the entire time that we were planning stuff as well.
But there's something
which is not ideal, but that just kind of happens sometimes.
Yeah.
Isn't there something kind of nice where you're like, hey, we found this great location. Can we change this scene? That there is a little back and forth between production and scripting,
yeah,
as opposed to like production racking their head over like how to accomplish a certain scene, mm-hmm, or like not using this awesome location because there's nothing really to go.
Yeah, I think it's nice, but also at the same time, like I like to plan so intensely that I think the script can still change if it has to when you get to that point. Mm-hmm. So. It's nice, but I don't think it like makes up for the fact of all these other things. We're like, we want to book this, but we don't know what our page count is. So we're just going to guess that we need 5 days here.
Right.
But we don't know if we need a six. And then if we don't, we're screwed. And so it's just like really guessing, like making a strip board off of guesses off an outline is hard.
Yeah.
How many episodes was it?
There's 10 episodes.
10 episodes?
Yeah.
Gotcha.
10 by 10.
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah.
And is it designed to be kind of, is it like a movie that you split up into 10 parts?
Yeah, basically. Like it follows the same movie structure, and we shot it more like a movie than we would a series. Because when they came in, they're like, oh, you can do this like 8 to 10 pages a day. And then after we had that experience where we did that many pages, I was like, no, I do not want to do this many pages a day. Like I personally love to do 5.5 pages a day, which, you know, every director does or even less. You know, you can't always get that.
I get, not that it happens very often, but if I have a page count that's too low, I get a little bored.
Really?
Yeah. Like I'm kind of like, all right, I got it in 4 or 5 takes. That's plenty.
Yeah. See, like, for me, it's
I could throw
like,
another angle at this, but.
Yeah, I don't know. I like, there could never be too low of a page count for me. I could go on, and that would be totally fine.
I've done projects where like the script really dictates how it's supposed to look. Like I did this Wendy's thing where it's supposed to be look like SportsCenter, right? Mm-hmm. And we just shot it exactly like how they shoot SportsCenter. So after we did all the lines and all the takes and all the alts and all the versions, we were like, we're done, you know?
Yeah.
We're like
it does done depend 2 hours on what early. You're shooting. Yeah.
But if you're doing something really like original or dramatic or narrative, I think when I know I'm shooting 3 pages today, then that's when we start getting crazy with the camera moves or try interesting performances or oners, mm-hmm, or whatever. And when you're shooting 10 pages a day, it's like wide, over. Let's move on.
Well, that project that we did together, I remember there was one time on set during that day where I had the client come up to me and she goes, can you shoot this in any less shots? Can you make this go any faster? And I said, right now we have 2 shots for 1 page of content. If you make me take out a shot, we have nothing to cut with.
Yeah.
So it has to be perfect, and that's going to make us go slower. So you need to let us get another shot.
So back up.
That's something I think all 3 of us probably relate to that is like frustrating with producers sometimes is that their ideas of how to save time and money are so arbitrary. Like, hey, we have 7 locations, let's cut it down to 5, or let's get rid of a character that I know that saves money, or you are shooting 2 shots per scene, can we find a way to shoot 1 shot? But they never think like, how does this affect like the storytelling or the final product or what we're making? Like there's never a, is this going to make it good or bad? It's always like, this is what I heard. And this project I'm working on now, the production company just like told us the other day, they're like, we love your outline and everything, let's cut it to about half these number of locations because that'll save us money. And I'm like, that does not,
and also you don't
that's
know
not that, true at all.
Yeah, we don't know if that's true or not, because like maybe you wrote it to a bad example, you wrote it to standing stages where it's like, on that shoot actually, we that same show we shot at Remet, which has like, oh, I shot a school, I shot Stranger Things, you shot a hospital room, mm-hmm, and an apartment, and a bar.
Yeah.
You know, that's the sort of stuff that, like, you kind of always just have, you can always have them handy. Like, you can find those sets wherever, but, like, cutting locations in that circumstance wouldn't save us any money at all.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, 2 scenes in the hospital room is probably worse than a scene in a hospital room in a bar in that circumstance.
Right. Yeah. Well, the one thing that I know is true that I feel like these people aren't always thinking about is that scope, like us as directors, we want our stuff to look like big Hollywood movies and big Hollywood TV shows. And so when they're like, okay, let's just set this whole scene in this warehouse or whatever, or the whole show or the whole episode, like there's nothing more boring than seeing like the same characters talking in the same location for 22 minutes or whatever. And if it is really good, like people always reference like, oh, that episode in Breaking Bad where it's just Jesse and Walt making meth the whole episode and chasing that fly. Like, first of all, that episode isn't good unless you've seen like the preceding like 30 episodes or whatever. And second of all, it's like, these are the best people on TV and they pulled it off and they're so applauded for it. But 99 out of 100 times, that's going to be a boring episode.
And that set is like super intricate. It's not just a single room. Do you know what I mean? Like, they really shot the shit out of that episode.
Yeah. So when a producer comes and says to Mercedes, hey, can you get this in one shot less? It's the same as saying, like, can you make this like a little bit worse?
Right? Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's what's hard about the fact that there's so much content now, is that we get to make a lot more content, but there's also less money being put towards it.
Right.
So it's like the opposite of, it's like, well, would you want to only shoot something every couple of years but have a lot of money, or would you rather constantly be working and be able to create all these series but your budgets are cut? And so that's just kind of like trading.
Well, do you guys ever like fight back and say like, hey, we can make 6 really great episodes or 10 not so good episodes, and I know you guys promised the client 10.
Yeah, I mean, so I actually line produce too, and so that's something I do, is I like look at the budgets and break them down. Mm-hmm. And they'll be like, yeah, look, this will save us money. I'm like, no, this will save you $200, which is nothing.
Right.
And we're losing this important character for this day. And right. So yeah, like if people tell me something isn't possible, I'll work the numbers if I don't like how the numbers are being worked, and be like, look, it is possible. Or on that show we did, I was supposed to do a musical episode and they're like, yeah, we can't have a choreographer. And I'm like, look, I can find you a choreographer for this amount of money and it's nothing for you guys that needs right. it. And they're like, cool. So I think it's just stuff like that.
Yeah.
Where it's just, if you know what you're doing and you know the numbers, you can tell people, you can call their bullshit and be like,
yeah,
no.
Back, it all goes back to drone shots.
I think, boy, God.
We always talk about how, like, the producers always are like, we can't afford the drone, and so.
No, it's more that, like, you budget for the drone and then it gets cut. That's the.
So that's why I bought a drone.
Yeah.
So that I can do my own drone.
Nice.
Well, let me ask you, Mercedes, so how would you define your style as a director? Like, what kind of stuff do you make?
Yeah. So I really love stuff that's elevated. I really love surrealism and fantasy and horror and genre stuff. But I really love genre stuff because I feel like genres have been done so many times from the same perspective. So bringing like a new female queer perspective to that, it helps renew it as well. And I love stuff that's not afraid to be really big or very violent or very sexual, which is always hard because clients don't like stuff that's too violent or sexual.
Well,
so you put stuff in there and they cut some back and you're like, okay, we kept that.
Do you do that thing where you put something in that you know is going to get cut? So that
I do.
Oh, cool. Can you name some of those things?
You guys, you missed out on that smile, everyone.
Oh man. Well,
that sly smile, that was good.
Yeah, I mean, I just say that, like, I'll do a scene that's very bloody and have the person get stabbed a couple more times that I know is going to be taken out, but you just go for it.
Right.
And whenever there's a fight scene written on the page where it's like, and it's over in a punch, I'm like, no, it's not over in a punch.
So. I love it when it's over in a punch, actually. I'm like, I want, like, that's why a thing I loved about Three Billboards, actually, is that, like, for the most part, like, people just got beat up relatively quickly and that was it. Like, I understand, like, violence has a place in cinema, but, like, I'm okay with it feeling a little more realistic. Like, if I got punched in the face, I would be on the ground crying after one punch and that would be that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, but there's a lot of fights that are, wouldn't you say most real fights are more than one punch?
I think if you get clocked like a good movie punch,
yeah,
I
like
think
a sucker
are,
punch.
Yeah, I think you're out basically in one punch.
Did like, you see Three Billboards?
Or it's really ugly and sloppy. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's like, very sloppy.
If no one connects, then yeah. But like, or like if there's kicking or something like that. But like for the most part, that still no one looks cool in that fight. The cool looking fights are pretty unbelievable to me. So like an ugly, stupid fight that's over as quickly as it would be in real life is very appealing to me.
See, I think that's like a personal thing for me, though, is like I don't always find believable interesting.
Sure, sure, totally.
Like that's what I think is really awesome about Kubrick movies is all the acting is very over the top, and that's way more fun than if their acting had been believable. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's important for people to be believable in their feelings, but the way in which they do things doesn't
something heightened is interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like I'm with Mercedes on the fights. Like, I've done so many things where, like, and then the guy comes and he punches him and he falls down and they, you know, the girl walks away or whatever. And we do it and I'm like, that just seemed really short and simple and anticlimactic. Like, I wish we had the budget and the time to choreograph like 10 punches. And then you see, like, the Punisher or some Marvel or Jessica Jones and, like, they're, you know, all those good things have like so many fight parts to
them. Mean because they take an entire day to do like a page,
right?
Yeah. And they have different units, which we don't always have. I've done so many fight stuff, it's like, well, we have to cut like most of the shots we had to, and we're getting it what it is, and which stinks.
Let's talk a little bit about like action fight scenes. What's like your style? Like, do you like to do like a lot of shots and cut fast to make them feel intense, or what's like what's your secret to make fake fights look good?
So I guess coming from the budget level that I'm currently directing is like you're not able to have actors for like months at a time to rehearse, and even like your stunt guys you're able to have months at a time, and like if you're able like to match your stunt guys, that's great, but you can't just shoot stuff static because it's just gonna look fake. And so I've done stuff where we're like, wow, we want to shoot it, you know, on these Steadicam shots and have these beautiful winners for these fights. And it's just because you have the time on the day doesn't mean that you had the budget and pre-production for that to work. And so in my experience, it's like, if you don't, you shoot it handheld and you hide it. And you like break it up enough that you're able to do that. And so,
because you're saying essentially that choreography is getting set the day of, everyone's kind of learning on the day, basically.
Not even learning the day, like we might have like two stunt rehearsals where we had like a full day and like a full studio where we had all the stunt people rehearse and all of our actors rehearse, but it's still like these actors were being taught how to throw punches then, instead of us having a month with them of really getting it down.
I did a show last year, I guess in 2016, where this one actress had to punch someone, and I mean, we must have done like 85 takes, and we're like, yeah, like just the way you're like moving your wrist at the end, it just, she was supposed to be like a major badass, and she just like couldn't, it was like an embarrassing punch, and just like the more we tried, we were like getting in her head, and she's like, was that good, and then
no, you know, one's having fun anymore.
I'm like, can I have someone else punch and I'll replace her arm? Like, it was so crazy. You basically at some point just have to take the not great punch because you have to move on because you're like losing light.
Or I just think that like with anything, it's like people have all these ideas. They're like, oh, if I would have shot it, I would have done it like this. And it's like, well, no, it's like you have to do it with the constraints that you have. It's like you have this amount of time in a day. And so this is how many setups you have. And you had this much time in rehearsal. And so like, you have to do it this way for it to look good. And so it's like, if I had more, I would shoot it different. But if I want it to look good, I have to do it a specific way.
Right.
Yeah.
And how carefully, sorry, I keep cutting Matt's questions off.
It's a story. It's 100 episodes almost.
Yeah. Well, so I guess I'm not sorry. How carefully do you plan out, let's say you're going to have a fight sequence, just like a hand-to-hand combat, maybe a weapon or like some blood. Do you storyboard like each shot? Do you have a shot list? How do you do you do one swing at a time and then reset and get a few takes and then go into the next move? Or what's the strategy?
Personally, for me, I think it's different for everyone, but I feel like shot listing is pretty pointless unless it's a huge set piece or unless there's a lot of VFX involved, because even if you're building the set, things change and people move differently in real life than you imagined in your head when you were like in front of your computer or drawing on a pad of paper. And it's hard to like draw dynamic shots that move all around the place if like it takes you that long to draw them. So I'm personally anti-storyboarding for fights. But what I like to do is I'll talk to the stunt coordinator, we'll figure out how it works, and then I like to shoot it on my iPhone during the rehearsal and cut it together on my computer. And so like whenever I have the No. So like no, in pre-production. So I'll like make this really shitty iPhone video.
No, that's
of I what love, it's gonna look
this
like.
This is so good. Yeah. I love that. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's like that's what Freddie Wong does too. Like,
yeah, it's cheap previs.
Yeah, yeah.
And you actually get to see how people move. And even if the DP's there, I'll have the DP like shoot it on the iPhone because that way like he can move with the actors. And like something I really like to do is have the DP shoot on like a really wide lens and get really close to them. Mm-hmm. And it's very dangerous because the DP I work with has gotten hit a couple times, but it looks really awesome when something is swinging right at the camera.
Yeah, yeah.
So having him be able to rehearse with them almost like a dance is like really great. Wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if you don't have that rehearsal day, do you still do that on set? The same thing.
I would never shoot a fight without a rehearsal day if it's an actual fight because I know that it just won't work out. So if it's like a punch, I don't think you need a rehearsal, but I would fight really, really hard to get a rehearsal day.
Okay, or so, sorry, yeah. Fights aside or action scenes aside, do you shot list for a normal scene, like a dramatic scene?
So I'm like a very controlling person. And so I like to shot list everything. But something I learned from the last project I did on Stargate is that I got a month of prep with my DP, which was awesome. We would meet like every single day and I got a lot of time with him. But then sometimes things on the day change, you know, like an actor might take an hour longer to get in makeup because it takes them 5 hours to get in makeup, or something will happen like your roof will break on your soundstage.
Right.
And so I like to use a shot list, even if it's some of it gets thrown out, almost as like, okay, we thought about all the things that we didn't like to come up with what we did like. So on the day, if they're like, okay, you have to cut 2 shots to make your day, I'm like, okay, well, I already know that we didn't like all these things in mm-hmm. pre-production. So even though we have to do something different, we like cut out 75% of the options. So this is like the next best thing.
Right.
So I make it to then throw it out.
Wait, sorry, I don't quite understand. So you like decide you're going to have 10 shots for the scene. And you decide which ones are the most important ones and the least important ones when you're shot listing.
So, yeah. So let's say I have a day and I'm like, okay, I know that I can have like 15 setups in this day. I'll make the shot list. I'll come in with it. But on the day, an actor's like, I don't want to walk there. That doesn't feel right to me. I need to walk here instead. Or if I have to combine a shot, I know that this shot can become this instead.
You've already thought through what you don't like,
yeah.
So you're free to come up with what you do like.
Exactly. So it mostly stays the same, but I know that if like we needed to have this crane shot, we can't have it, like not all is lost because we come up with the next best thing in like a minute.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
Do you try to have like a cinematic language for everything you do, like, you know, we're going to shoot all this wide, you know, wide close up or when
like a set of rules for how you shoot.
Yeah.
A thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd say that each project I like to come up with a set of rules. And so that's what we know what we're dealing with. Mm-hmm. And I feel like with every project you get better about that and you learn like, okay, these are what these lenses look like. And even with, you know, shooting everything on your iPhone, like I love to go on Artemis, which is this awesome app you use with DPs, and you can choose out which lenses you're on. So that way we actually know what it looks like and we choose those ahead of time.
I've always Artemis also sells like those like lenses that you can actually put on your phone to help match some of the wider angles, and I've never seen them in real life, but I'm very curious about them. You
Me
know what
too.
I mean?
I haven't used those actually.
Like it would be neat to have you used them?
No, but I was just on the scout the day before yesterday, and like, you know, I know we're gonna have an 18 millimeter lens, and so like, and we're shooting like inside an attic and we're shooting inside a utility closet, like these insanely tiny areas. So I know we're going to be on that lens a lot, even just for like a close up of like a face. And so I was shooting all these shots on my phone, but it crops like the sides off. Yeah.
Yeah.
In Artemis.
Listeners, if you guys have used the Artemis lenses, I'd love to hear about them. Or Artemis, send us some and we'll review them on the show. Shout out to Artemis. Mercedes, I have a question actually. I think one of the things that's really especially fun when you're kind of leveling up and you're getting bigger crews and you're getting more pre-pro time and kind of all of these different things, you get exposed to different craftspeople that you didn't maybe necessarily have a relationship with when earlier in your career, right? So like a stunt coordinator or a second unit director, things like that. And I find that I always learn a lot from them, especially stunts. It's like that's such a unique vocabulary in a different world. What are some things that maybe you picked up from people that you got to work with on this new project?
I'd say the biggest thing is that things can be custom built instead of you having to pick what's available.
Oh, cool.
And so especially with costumes, I would sit down with my costume designer instead of her just looking through houses or picking up stuff, like she would actually build stuff by hand. And so we got to get stuff that's completely custom. And so it opens your mind up creatively.
Yeah.
So things like that are really nice.
Was that ever a burden? Are you ever like, can't you just go get a jumpsuit or something?
No, because I've always wanted to do more than what's possible. Yeah. So I think that's a big thing.
Wardrobe. So Stargate, obviously, you had to kind of create a whole world. How do you like go about designing the costumes and the makeup?
For this, we wanted to do something. What I really like about Stargate is it's sci-fi meets historical. And so we were set in 1939, but we were in this sci-fi world. And
a period piece plus laser gates and stuff.
Yeah.
Well, so without revealing Stargate, too much. Right? Yeah. They go into it's like Indiana Jones time with sci-fi.
So what's cool about that is so we had to stay really historically accurate, but we could also elevate things. Mm-hmm. And so we looked at a lot of references from Vogue and different fashion editorials because we wanted to elevate it instead of just copying stuff historically.
You mean Vogue from the 1920s?
Vogue, just like magazine.
Like current editorial. Vogue.
Current Vogue. Yeah. Because something that current Vogue does is they look at different cultures and they mash it up and use different materials than people would have used back then. And so that's something I really liked, is instead of just copying this, how do we elevate it? So that's something we did for the costume.
So just to get into the nitty gritty, do you just start going on Google and Pinterest and Flickr?
Pinterest is the best. Yeah.
And you are just pulling images and building a book to show your costume designer?
Yeah. Yeah. I'll make Pinterest pages and they'll bring me Pinterest pages and we just have a Pinterest fest basically.
Cool. Gotta get better at Pinterest.
Yeah. I'm I have trouble.
I'm Dropbox. But that's just it's like a dumber version of
Dropbox.
Pinterest
doesn't help you discover images.
Sure,
Dropbox,
I guess that's true. Yeah, yeah. But I guess what I mean is I'm not good at making board. Pinterest boards. Yeah, yeah. Something about the interface is still clunky for me.
But isn't the whole point of a Pinterest board that you can find a lot of related images and stuff on Pinterest?
Yeah, well, once it starts knowing you, it starts suggesting stuff for you, which is cool because it starts learning your style and it will show you stuff. Oh, I never thought of that. Thank you, Pinterest.
That's actually my problem with Pinterest and everything, actually, Facebook and Instagram, is that, and I mean, it's not like I invented this problem. Everyone has this problem, but it starts trying to guess what you would like, and it's hard to get out of your, predetermined lane. So it's I want my stuff to look like Vogue, Egyptian Vogue, but Pinterest would never suggest that to me because I've never looked at anything like that.
You haven't adventured out enough.
Yeah, I just have trouble on Pinterest. I feel like I keep finding the same things over and over. I feel like it's Google Images, where I have to think of the search term.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I mean, it doesn't just do it for you, but it's a good tool that I like to use. I'm trying to think of other departments that I learned stuff from that didn't.
Well, let me ask you this question that I asked at our live show. Actually, I think it's my new question, because I never know the answer to this myself, but how do you decide whether you're going to shoot something handheld or on sticks or dolly or Steadicam?
Yeah. So for me personally, I think it's different from person to person, but my projects always have a mix of all of them. And so for me, I've noticed that if you have handheld in a scene where the characters aren't moving, you notice the handheld a lot. Mm-hmm. And so I actually did a scene recently where it's just two characters sitting down and we're like, oh, in this scene, they get up and they start arguing at each other. So this whole scene should just be handheld. But for the beginning, they're just sitting down. And it's just was really awkward and we had to stabilize it in post because you just noticed the camera. Yeah. So I think if the characters are moving around and they're upset or they're going somewhere, that works. Handheld works. But if not, it's just you're not paying attention to them.
Well, what about Steadicam, though, versus a handheld?
Yeah. I mean, so Steadicam, I think, can be used in a lot of different ways. Something, I don't know if you guys saw Joseph Kahn's Bodied recently.
Mm-mm.
Joseph Kahn does all the Taylor Swift music videos. Right. And he had this feature.
And a new episode of Crazy Ex-Girlfriend.
Really?
Yeah, dude, it's so good.
That's awesome.
Oh, you guys should definitely check it out. It's like real Joseph Kahn-y.
Oh my God.
It's cool. I was like, oh, why don't they have more music video directors do this show?
That's right. You know, I told you he was the director. I got fired from one job in Hollywood.
You got fired
from
on
his set. Yeah, the Jamiroquai music video.
Oh, that's right.
Oh my God. Yeah. I want to hear
not the Jamiroquai music video.
Not the A Jamiroquai music video.
But something he does is he uses Steadicam in a way that you wouldn't expect before. Like, he'll use it in dialogue conversations. And so people will just be talking and he'll like go around their heads for comedic mm-hmm. effect, or he'll like go back and forth between people a lot. And so I don't really think there's a rule for Steadicam of when you can and can't use it.
Yeah. I guess there's also, you know, that I feel like there was a time where like every DP, I'd be like, let's just like dolly in on this conversation. Let's just kind of like move back and forth. And they'd be like, that's like, why? It's totally unmotivated. And I'm like, I don't know. It just looks cooler.
Yeah.
And so I kind of stopped doing that because like all these film people like taught me not to move the camera if there's no reason to move the camera.
Yeah,
but now,
I mean, I think do whatever you want, but
yeah.
Yeah, I guess the handheld when people aren't moving, a show that I reference a lot of, so I'm up for like a lot of comedy commercials, and I reference Modern Family all the time, like that look, because it's handheld and it's like kind of docu-style, but it's like really clean, really perfectly lit, really perfect. The camera moves, even though they're handheld, they mm-hmm. are perfectly choreographed.
Yeah.
But it's handheld, even if two people are just standing somewhere.
But I think in that case, it's because the entire show is like that you don't realize it. But I think if you've been static for like a whole show and all of a sudden everything goes from like just straight on and then all of a sudden it's moving, it really throws you out of it. And because I bounce back and forth between stuff, it's like, okay, how do we transition between this?
I love that you bounce back and forth, because I feel like I tend to more or less stick to one style throughout the entirety of a piece. You know, it's either like, you know, sticks and dolly, the studio or handheld.
But what about like Shitty Boyfriend or a longer form thing?
Shitty Boyfriends was sticks and dolly except for one scene. And
oh,
it
really?
Was like the breakup scene.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And zero steady or movie.
Yeah. Something
that was a budget thing though.
Yeah. You know? It's always partially a budget thing. But something I've been trying to do lately is just, instead of thinking like, oh, it has to be sticks or it has to be Steadicam, is thinking about what I want the move to be and then choosing which one of those,
what tool they use,
like matches the move that's in my head, which producers hate because we get a lot of different types of equipment.
Yeah, sure.
But for me, guys, that's why I like switch back and forth between stuff, because it's like, oh, I want it to move in this way, and mm-hmm. which one works for that.
I'm really into like kind of a more old-fashioned style of handheld lately. That I haven't been able to use as much as I'd like, but I think basically post The Office and post like the Bourne movies, when people say Steadicam, they mean like shaky cam or really active camera work, right? Whereas like, you know, like French New Wave is like handheld, but like not trying to show off that it's handheld. They're almost trying to hide it, but they still want those cool camera moves. And so there's something really organic and cool and grounded about it that you kind of lose in Steadicam, but that doesn't call as much attention to itself. So if you were, say, shooting a steady or a handheld close-up, for instance, you're not floating the way you would if you were doing it Modern Family style, for instance, you know?
Right. I worked with this camera operator. We used to call him like a cruise cam, or I forget what, something along those lines, because he was always like kind of bouncing back and forth. Mm-hmm. Like he didn't notice he was doing it.
They look like they're kind of dancing.
You're on a cruise ship and you're kind of rocking back and forth just because they're like,
and
can't
that
stand
is
still.
That is the style right now. But like, there's something really elegant about like a nice controlled handheld move.
Well, I've definitely been on sets where we're shooting something and I'm like, this just kind of doesn't look very interesting. Can we just go to handheld?
Well, sometimes it's just like, it doesn't feel alive.
Yeah.
The artsy way to describe it. But yeah, it just feels kind of dead and restricted sometimes.
Yeah. And that's when like your operator really becomes so important, right?
Yeah.
Like their style.
Yeah.
Well, awesome. Well, I feel like we've been talking to you for 15 minutes.
Well, I've got one other question that we can talk about a little bit that really struck me. So when we, at that crazy day, we sat down and we were talking at lunch, and you're like younger than me, right? And young enough to like, it was like an influencer show, and you were young enough to like and have watched internet videos with your friends. And like, I'm just old enough for like, DSL wasn't a thing until basically I got to college. And so that's a very interesting generational divide for me, of like, people who grew up with streaming video versus not. And so it's fascinating to me to think of like, oh, like up and coming directors now watched and consumed internet video when they were coming of age in a way that obviously hasn't ever happened before. And like, if you think about that paradigm shift with TV, that's the difference between Cheers and The Simpsons. Do you feel like the internet informed your opinion of doing digital work, or how did it affect you artistically?
Maybe? Yeah, so that's actually really interesting that you say that. Because, yeah, I grew up watching YouTube videos with my friend, and when I go on set and I've worked with influencers, I was actually like, oh my god, when I was in seventh grade I wanted to marry you.
Yeah, exactly.
And so it's something I actually grew up with and watched, and even now I like watching YouTube influencers because I think it's like,
who are your favorites? I'm curious.
Oh man, who are my favorites? I really love Brandon Rogers is one of my favorites.
Yeah, I know who that is.
Yeah,
took me a minute. He does
extremely offensive and out there.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so I do think that's influenced my style, because I was working with an exec recently, and her way of watching TV and the way it was shot was very different of how I watched things. And for her, you don't go into a close-up a lot. Like, that's unheard of. Like, you stay farther back. You don't realize or recognize that the camera's there as much. You don't see as much handheld. And for me, I was okay with seeing stuff in extreme close-ups. And I was okay if people looked in the camera and it became first POV and stuff like that. But for her, that was like a big no-no. And you don't go there. And I really do think that's a generational thing.
That's interesting. Yeah, yeah. That makes sense.
Well, there's this really interesting thing in a blink of an eye, you know, the Walter Murch book, that he said when he edits, I mean, he's editing movies for movie theaters, but he would say that he would make like a little cardboard cutout of a human and put it next to his monitor to show him like, this is how big a person is going to be in the movie theater relative to the screen. And so...
So Bryce, you just have... Mercedes, you have a cutout. Yeah. A cardboard cutout.
Yeah.
Next to your screen.
Yeah. And actually, oh my... So, really interesting. So, now that we're shooting stuff for digital, we shoot stuff differently and we do it closer because we're looking at little screens. And I have a friend who's a Japanese director, and people over there watch everything on their screens. Like, everyone has the little flip out on their phone because whenever you're waiting, you're at a table, you just put your phone in front of you and you watch things like that. And so, for him, like... Something he told me is like, yeah, if you want to have impact of someone moving, if they move from left to right on the screen, you see them moving space more if they move forward or backwards, because if you're viewing like a little 3x5 thing, that's different. And you shoot everything closer and wides don't have as much impact. Mm-hmm. And so it just changes the style of shooting. And so I think that's really influenced me.
The motion thing was that left to right movement is more impactful than front, towards the camera than away from the camera.
Yeah. So little things like that. And also, I think also just jump cuts, where you'll cut from a medium to someone and a close-up of someone, and that's acceptable in the YouTube world. Mm-hmm. And that's acceptable in Japanese editing, but here it's not, and you never see that. And so it jars people a lot more. But back to the younger thing, I mean, that's also something I deal with all the time.
Sure. Yeah.
Is people are like, oh my god, you're so young. And I'll work on a lot of sets where I'm the youngest person on set, and even like all the PAs have been older than me, and people always question that. And it's like, well, we're creating content for people this age, and I put as just many hours into it as anyone else has.
Sure. Well, you know, it's funny because I feel like the way that I found out that you were as young as you are is because you had mentioned how excited you were about meeting some influencer.
That's what gives it up usually.
And I was like, wait a minute. Which is really funny. So, but you find it to be challenging?
Yeah, I think just challenging because people like to use age as a thing to compare. Like, oh, when I was your age, I was doing this. So there's no way you can do that because I had to put in my time.
Right.
Or it's just like, usually it's people who are insecure about themselves feel like that. And if people are secure, they don't really care.
My guess is 95% of these people are just kind of jealous of you.
Yeah. And I don't know. I mean, it's weird. Like, I understand.
Whatever, haters.
Whatever, haters, deal with it.
I mean, kind of for real, though.
Yeah. Do I don't know. I think it's just like with the whole, like, people are sexist. It's like people are also ageist, and people are always going to be against you for something that's different than them. And so I think it's just like being like, okay, look at the job I'm doing, look at the work I'm doing, and that literally doesn't matter whatsoever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that's the truth. Yeah. I mean, that's kind of what we talk about all the time. Like, if the work is good, it doesn't really matter. How can we, what's the deal with Stargate? When does that come out?
Oh, yeah. So that comes out in February. And there's going to be two episodes released every week.
February, what?
Throughout February.
And do you know, do you have to go to that MGM portal or will it
be on
YouTube?
Yeah, so it's
going to
be on Stargate Command.
Cool. And is that, do you need a subscription or anything?
Yeah. So it's a subscription and you're able to watch all the other Stargate content there as well.
Can you watch the first episode free?
Yes. The first episode will be free.
Perfect. Oh, awesome.
Yeah.
Cool. And then how can we find out more about you and your career?
You can go on my website, which is MercedesBriceMorgan.com. And yeah, I'm not too much of a social media person, even though my agents tell me I should be more of a social media person.
Can we get your email address?
No, that is off the website.
Before we sign off, we have a final segment that where we talk about things we like. And so we're going to go into that real quick.
Two, one. Unpaid endorsements.
Da 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 da. Thanks, guys.
The unpaid endorsements jingle you just heard was sung by everyone that was at our live show. So thanks, people, for coming to our live show.
Everybody, thanks so much.
And singing the jingle. This is, as usual, a dumb one. Has nothing to do with filmmaking. But my car has been hit on the street multiple times while it was parked. And every time it gets hit, I lose it for quite a few days while they're replacing parts of it or whatever. And I can't get around. In LA, you have to have a car. You can kind of use Uber if you're very wealthy, but it's way easier if you have a car. So then I have to go and rent a car. And every time I tell myself I should add the rental policy to my insurance, and I never do. So I'm telling you, people, add it. It's like $30 a year. You'll get a free rental car. So not only do you not have to pay for your car rental when your car is getting fixed, but everyone involved is motivated to get your car fixed faster. Because if you're paying for your own rental car, they don't care to hurry up the the repairs. But if they're paying for it, then they do. So get the rental car insurance on your insurance policy. That's my endorsement for the day.
Good advice.
Mercedes.
All right. So something I've been doing recently is trying to watch really good low-budget horror films.
Cool.
So kind of late to the game. But that's because there's so much content. Sure. So you'll always be late to the game for something. So I watched It Follows for the first time recently.
Yes, good. So good, right?
Yeah, and it's on Netflix. So good. Yeah. And I watched The Witch for the first time recently.
Cool. Is that on Netflix?
No, I watched it on Amazon Prime.
Yeah, it's included in Amazon Prime, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
I've been meaning to watch it. I heard the director. Man. Do you know the director? Someone we had on the podcast knew the director, and supposedly he made a short film for The Witch, and he like made all the props himself and like built like everything.
He comes from production design, and so like he made all the set of The Witch, and I think all of the clothing are all period appropriate, down to the point where like he used the tools of that era to make the cabin that they live in.
Wow. That is amazing. That's like it's really method geeking production out. Design.
And also, it's almost exclusively natural light. There's a couple, like they'll use actual candles in certain circumstances. Like there's a few shots that they supplement with light panels, but for the most part, it's 100% natural.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
What's the budget? Is it low budget?
Oh God, I don't remember exactly. It's not like Blair Witch budget. Is like 2 to 3 million.
That sounds right.
And It Follows is like 2 million.
Yeah, that's
That's like not really that low budget for a horror film.
Yeah,
compared to like a Blair Witch or a Paranormal Activity.
Yeah.
Right?
But what I really liked about especially It Follows is it's a really high concept thing that you could really get execs excited about, and it's really easy to pitch. But then the way they shot it was more like an art film, and they took risks. And so that's what really appeals to me, is it's really hard to sell something, especially it's like, here's this really artsy out there idea, and people are like, pass. Like,
nope. Yeah.
But if you have a concept like
it follows. It's a metaphor.
But if you have a concept like It Follows, and then everyone buys into it and is open to watching something that they want.
I do think it's like kind of execution dependent, though, right? Like you could see a bad version of that movie.
I mean, there's totally the slasher version of that movie, which when I went to watch it, that's what I was expecting, and then I didn't see that. I was like, whoa, because that's what the trailer makes it seem like.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Like there's from the trailer, you don't understand that at all.
There's also like a really interesting timeless quality to it. Yeah. You know, that girl has the, like, it kind of feels like a period piece.
She has the clamshell thing, yeah. And it's not set, or they purposely did that, is like all the cars and the set dressing, all of it's from different time periods, so you're constantly guessing what time period it is.
That's cool. Yeah, I didn't pick up on that.
I want to see It Comes at Night. Have you heard of that one?
Oh, yeah,
I've heard that.
I saw the trailer for that, and I was like, that's too scary for me.
Okay, so actually, I am anti-trailer now.
Oh, yeah.
I don't watch trailers because I think trailers give away way too much information, and usually it has nothing to do with, like, if I like the movie or not. Totally. So all the movies I've been watching recently, I purely watch because people personally recommend it to me.
Yeah.
And also, they just give away all these plot points.
Yeah, it's like, oh, come on, man.
Yeah.
I try to embargo myself from any information after I've decided I'm going to watch the movie. So at whatever sometimes it takes a trailer to be like, oh yeah, I do want to see that. But if I know I'm going to see it, I'll avoid all that stuff.
What I love about trailers, it's the opposite of what you just said, Mercedes, which is that trailer shows me how this movie was sold usually, you know?
Mm, yeah.
Like, oh, this, you know, this actor, this person is doing this thing. Like, here's the setup. Here's the elevator pitch is the trailer.
Yeah, I think it's almost fun to watch trailers after you watch the movie then.
Yeah.
Or like with Fight Club, they sold it as this like action-y thing that these bro-y dudes fight out, and the movie's not like that, and that's why it didn't do well until later.
Yeah,
it's like the classic example.
And for the record, $2 million was the budget for It Follows and $4 million for The Witch.
$4
million,
wow.
They were like mostly in one location the whole time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you had to get the tools. You have to get like an old
you gotta
iron.
Get the tools.
It took them a long time. Yeah, there are no stars in that movie either. That's interesting.
They only ate like food that you can have back then.
A lot of
gruel and things.
Yeah. Goat's milk.
Or have you guys seen Don't Breathe? That's like,
yeah.
Okay,
yeah, I love
Don't Breathe. It's awesome.
Yeah.
And I thought that was like $2 million. I looked it up and I'm pretty sure the budget's like 10 or 15 million.
Yeah.
That's
like, yeah. Sometimes
what?
Like, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. One location.
They probably like custom built the house. Like,
yeah.
Yeah. But still, it's like.
I mean, it takes money to make a movie.
Oh,
right?
I mean, yeah. Give more money. Yeah.
Love it.
Ex Machina, you know that movie?
Mm-hmm.
That was like $20 million or some. Or,
well, yeah, it's a VFX movie.
Yeah, they have like intense VFX. I believe that.
It's one VFX shot that they just repeat over and over.
But people call that a low-budget sci-fi.
Yeah, but people are like, oh, it's like a small indie film that exploded.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, not really.
Relax. Well, cool. Well, my endorsement is the Maria Bamford Show. Do you guys know this show?
I love Maria Bamford.
That's on Netflix?
Not Lady Dynamite. The Maria Bamford Show is an old super deluxe web series that she did where she plays all of the characters. If you're a fan of Lady Dynamite or Maria Bamford, it's totally worth checking out because it's a lot of the early material that she uses for the show. But it is like clearly shot with like a crappy camera in her house in Los Feliz. And is just like an example of like early web series. It was like, oh, this is what we used to watch on the internet, and we were all very excited about it. And it's that handcrafted nature is really charming and great, and the storytelling is awesome. And it was the first digital video, like web series, that I loved, like for real. And I think it's kind of an interesting thing that I think a lot of people make digital series, present company excluded, but make digital series and don't love any of that content at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's like a pretty big mistake to be like, oh, I'm going to make this thing. And then like literally not have an opinion or have seen any of it. Like you can be an indie filmmaker and be awesome. But if you don't love a specific format or the way that an audience perceives that format, what are you doing?
Yeah. I think like looking at that, even on a bigger level, I think that's a problem with a lot of big budget movies is the execs aren't fanboys or fangirls of the genre.
Sure.
And so they'll look at horror and they'll be like, why is this so gory? Or they'll look at a comedy and they're like, this has too many jokes. Like, why is it trying to be funny? And so
or
I think
not
it's just
funny.
Right. It's people who don't like the stuff that they're giving notes or making. It's like,
yeah, it happens in branded content all the time because somehow like people will convince a client, like an agency or a client or someone to like, do like, oh, this is really popular, let's do a show like this. But then the people that are doing that you're advertising for like don't know that show, don't like it, and don't want their brand to be associated with like a gory horror film or something, or like fart jokes. So it's like, why are you even doing it in the first place unless you're a fan of it?
What's better is when they call it out in pre-production instead of post.
Oh, yeah.
Like, we made this? Like, yeah, that's what you asked for.
We showed you the animatic.
Well, stay tuned, everyone, for my fart horror movie coming in 2019.
Sounds scary.
Sounds pretty good.
Stinky.
Thanks so much, Mercedes. This was excellent.
Thank you, guys.
Well, if you want to check out all of the stuff that we talked about, show notes, our unpaid endorsements, and a little bit more about Mercedes, you can go to justshootitpod.com. You can follow us on Twitter at justshootitpod, on Instagram at justshootitpod. You get the pattern. Do us
Please like us on Facebook. Leave us a review on iTunes. That would be so awesome. It's the only way that this show gets to grow.
And leave us a voicemail at 2626-SHOOT-1. We love answering your questions. And it's great to hear your voices. It's real flattering. We love it. You can follow me at Mr. Matt Enlow.
And me at Smitey Pyleg. This episode was edited by Jay McAuliffe, and our webmaster is Ewan Williams. And the music that you're listening to right now is provided by the Free Music Archive and the artist Jazar. Thanks a lot for listening. Write us a note. We'll see you next time.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.